Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
I am the time.
Good evening. Here we are in the UK. It's 7 o'clock here in the UK. I believe it's 2 p.m. Eastern time, and we are here back live on Strategic Breakthrough Radio with me, Elliot Kay. I'm a strategist, and what I do is I work with entrepreneurs, business owners, speakers, coaches to help them strategically build a business that's cash rich, that's scalable, and more importantly, supports the lifestyle you want to live. And this show is all about strategy. And every couple of weeks, I bring in experts in their space, in the industry, who are out there making a dent in the universe, impacting people's lives, and are simply making this world a better place through their own methodologies. We've had a variety of guests. And of course, you're very welcome to either call in or tweet me directly, Elliot K, PTS, that's Elliot Kay, PTS, Papa Tango Sierra. Any questions you might have throughout the show. Now, this show, I've known this gentleman for a while, and he has taken the whole concept of being disruptive to a new level. And I couldn't resist but ask him on the show. He's also a very charming young man, and he's just full of energy, full of what would be the word? Full of beans, as we say in the UK. I was looking for a polite way to say full of, you know, but anyway, we won't go there right now. And it's interesting because before I actually introduce him, I asked a few people what they understood disruptor, to be a disruptor is. And I actually went to a marketing conference a while ago, and I think you'll find this amusing. And I actually asked on stage, there were a group of 8 marketing experts. And I asked them what they thought disruptive marketing meant. And most of them agreed that they felt it was a bit like punching yourself in the face and then asking someone to buy from you. Now, I know that's not the case. I know that's not the case. And I know this is not what this gentleman stands for. But I thought it was interesting that from a marketing perspective, some marketeers see as that. Now, I know Keaton, the guy that I'm going to introduce you to shortly, is going to talk all about that. And we're going to hear and get to know him very well. But before we do that, just to give you a bit of background about the guy. So he's award-winning mindset, and he's a strategist. And he's all about not just having a solid strategy, he's all about having a solid mindset. But today we're going to focus more on the strategy as well as the mindset. And this is what he says. He believes in disruption for positive outcomes. By changing perceptions, you can change behaviors. These behaviors changes allows people to adopt better attitudes, which in turn changes their action, giving them the results they desire. He's also an award-winning entrepreneur. The guy's done a lot, and I've watched him. He travels, he bounces from plane to plane, place to place, and it's all done with a smile on his face. Let's give a good Strategic Breakthrough Radio welcome to Keaton. Keaton, how are you doing, buddy?
Good evening, Elliot, and good evening, everyone that's listening out there. It's wonderful to be here. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And I just want to say I didn't pronounce your last name because I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, and I'd rather not pronounce it than mispronounce it. So if you would like to enlighten us on how to pronounce your last name.
Okay, so my name is Keaton Makwana.
Makwana, there we go. That was easy. I don't know what I was worried about. But these days and age, you know, it's so easy to offend people by mispronouncing their name. So there we go. So Keaton Makwana is with us here. So tell us just before we get into your whole ethos, your philosophy, because you've got some really interesting points we're going to cover on this show. And of course, if you're listening on replay, you can find out how to connect with Keaton direct. We're going to give all that details out throughout the show. Just tell us a little bit about your background, because I think it wasn't too long ago that you pretty much lost everything. Is that about right? Am I off track? Am I on track?
Yeah. Sort of professionally, I was in a career spanning IT, electronics, healthcare, up till about 2009, I was what we call a career geek. I wanted to become a senior director and executive within a corporation. I kind of developed and worked my way through a career, everything from being seconded to Apple when they launched the iMac in the late 90s, right the way through to introducing a patient call information system into the NHS here in the UK over a five-year stint with an electronics company, to bringing the world's smallest dialysis machine to the UK in 2009, at which point I was told I was surplus to requirement. Meaning that the recession was hitting, the economic climate was uncertain. Most large companies were taking that as an opportunity to shed the skin of employment that they had within within the business, just so they can maintain their shareholders, their shareholders' investments and stuff like that. And I was a victim of that. So in 2009, I pretty much was facing a very uncertain, very dark, and very kind of confusing future. So, and 2009 was a very poignant time for me as well, Elliot, because I had two very young children. I was a sole earner in the house, and raising a young family with all the other bills, bells, and whistles that go with it. It was just like many others out there. It was a time where you start to look forward and say, "What am I going to do next?"
So you were kind of on this amazing path. And then you experienced what a lot of people experienced, and you experienced it a bit later, because most people went through that in 2008. So was it your typical walk into the office? So did you almost think you were safe and immune? And then you walked in and they were like, "Hey, sorry, kitten, you're out."
Well, it was interesting because when the economic crash really kind of happened in 2008, you could hear the vibrations going around you. But the healthcare industry at that point was slightly still a little bit more protected, or perhaps it was a year behind in its kind of state of reaction to these climates. When recruitment freezes started to come across the industry, that's when we started to feel the pinch. And very much like you just described, it was a situation where I walked into the office, sat down in my own office. Next thing you know, I've got the MD knocking on my door saying, "Can you come and see me?" At which point I thought, right, okay, I'm either going to be rewarded or reprimanded for something. I was neither. It was just warned. I just literally got to the stage where they just said, "Look, it's currently unsustainable for us. You're now at risk of redundancy." But within 24 hours of that notice, I was put at high risk. So, it wasn't even the case of you're out. It was you're at risk, which is even worse, because at least this kind of way would, if they just said to you, "You are going to go through it and it's all over," at least you can make a decision. But the fact that they put you at risk leaves it even more untenable, unjustifiable, unrepairable. So, I had a million and one things going on in my head. Do I come home and even tell my wife that I'm going to lose my job? Do I want to create that kind of burden and stress? I recall really deeply that one evening when I drove home from work, just had dinner, went to bed. The lights were switched off, but I could really clearly see the ceiling above me. And it was all about, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Who's going to give me a job? It was all me, until I exhausted every possible thought I have potentially about myself. And then I started to think about what was happening around me. Interesting. Next day, I still haven't told my wife anything. I went back to work, knocked on the MD's door, and sat down, and I just did what I thought was absolutely insane at that time. And I'm a believer that insanity, you have to have insanity. So that, for anything sane, it starts with something insane. And what I actually did is I walked into his office, sat down, and I said, "Right." I said, "I'll accept the redundancy on one condition." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "That you give me a job." And he looked at me as most people would look and say, "Right, you're under the stress of this. We can understand how it's going to impact you and all this years, but do you really understand the words that are coming out your mouth?" And I said, "Well, you're listening with the intent to respond and not the intent to understand." And what I actually took him through very quickly is to say that the bottom line of it is right now you can't afford us as employees because of the economic climate. At some point, there is going to be a recovery. There will be more confidence in the market. And as a business, you'll want to grow. But by then, you've removed or shed all the resources that you have within your business, at which point you get a contractor in while you find the perfect employee to fill that position. And most contractors don't have culture understanding. They don't understand your customers. They don't understand your processes. They're just there to pick up a bill and a wage and just serve whatever it is that you want serving. I said, I know all of this stuff. I said, so I can pretty much run your contracts as a contractor to you rather than an employee. So I said to him, yeah, I'll accept the condition that you give me a job. And to cut a long story short, I went from employed to unemployed to self-employed, and my first client was the very company that was making me redundant.
That's brilliant. Reminds me, we had a podcaster called Ben on here, and he mentioned that he really loved podcasting, and then he ended up working with his company as because he wanted to get involved with the whole podcasting, and in the end, he ended up signing him up as a client to be his editor. And it's just interesting how innovative people can become under very unusual circumstances, which is one of your slants of and approaches to things as well. Like you said, within insanity, there's sanity. With insanity, there's insanity. And of course, you know, growth comes from being very, very uncomfortable. And you were clearly very uncomfortable. But, you know, what you did, I mean, you didn't have a grieving period, which a lot of people go through when they're in that situation. It seemed like you accepted the situation really quickly and you were like, okay, what's the solution? Which is a very entrepreneurial and solution-orientated mindset. Were you always like that, though? Were you always a solution-driven kind of guy?
Unconsciously, entrepreneurial traits were within me since I kind of decided to leave university and just pursue a career. I've always kind of been someone that comes up with either new ideas or new ways to improve processes, create efficiencies or effectiveness. But I wouldn't have said to you, you know, during that kind of career span that I was an entrepreneur or thought entrepreneurially, or those kind of words didn't really exist in people's vocabularies back then, to be honest with you, especially mine. The fact that, you know, I come up with something so fast is it was really based on the fact that I'd exhausted every possible thought I could have about me. And, you know, I thought there are two things I could do. I could either sit and wallow in the pain and actually try and, you know, join that list of ratios of 2,000 middle managers to one job, or I'll go and create my own one. And, you know, it was, you know, at that point, even when I kind of put forward my foot forward, I mean, it's quite easy for the company to actually turn around and say, no, we don't need you. And yes, you're going to get remain redundant anyway. So it could have been a lost loss. I mean, the fact that what came out of it was actually very surprising to the company as much as it was to me, then gave me some sort of courage or confidence to start pushing out into the market even more. So I thought, if one healthcare company is having this issue, I'm sure others are. So I did the same thing multiple times over and actually ended up actually winning quite a lot of contracts in a very short space of time. So entrepreneurship, I guess, you know, to answer your question, is something that I now see from hindsight because I'm in that sphere. But before, I would have been very unconscious to it. But anyone that's listening to this, that's employed or within a career, if you are someone that constantly comes up with new ways or tinkering with models to try and produce effectiveness and new results and efficiency, you are actually very entrepreneurial in the outset.
That's quite interesting. And by the way, if you have any questions or you want to ask us anything live, just feel free to dial in. Unfortunately, it's only in America you can use this number, but it's 646-716-7979. That's 646-716-7979. If you want to call in and ask myself or Ketan a question here on anything he's talking about, within reason, keep it clean, of course. but by all means, or you can tweet to me direct, Elliot K, P-T-S, E-L-L-I-O-T-K-A-Y, and then P-T-S, the letters P-T-S. Which stands for power to succeed, but that's had a different conversation. You see, I remember when I was employed and I was corporate, and I always looked in, you know, to innovate and find new ways because it was very ingrained in me, like you mentioned. And I used to think that entrepreneur was a title that was awarded to you, like, you know, like an MBE or a Sir. I used to think that you went somewhere and someone, behold, you are now an entrepreneur, Elliot Kay. I really used to think that. So how naive I was. I really did. I was like, well, how'd you get this title? I mean, as you know, Richard Branson, an entrepreneur, and all these people are entrepreneurs. Where'd you get it from? And then I realized gradually that I was one. And I think now even the word entrepreneur can be overused and misused. Hmm. A bit like, you know, and we're going to come to this, as well as some of your achievements, but a bit like the word passion. You know, passion is a massively overused word in this day and age. And it's a bit like, for me, passion and the word service are very abused in the space of entrepreneurship and as well as personal development and even in the strategy space. And one of your core things is passion is not enough. So do you want to go into that a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, you hear it all the time. I mean, when I was coming in, you know, my business operates primarily within the personal development industry and also within the business development industry. And you hear it all the time from experts and keynote presenters and the amount of YouTube videos people put out and these memes that they do on Facebook and all these other social platforms about passion. You've got to have passion. You've got to love what you got to do. And I'm like, yes, you know, to a certain context, you do. You have to be in that environment where you are entirely happy with what you're working on. But passion, in my opinion, is not enough. It's just not enough. It's kind of passion gets you up in the morning. Passion will get you dressed and get you down to work. But that's where it stops. You know, eventually, passion is a bit like a hot air balloon. It can fizzle its hot air, which means it starts to deflate, and then you need to reinflate it again. You need inspiration to keep your passion going. What I believe in is that passion needs to be combined with frustration or anger. And what I mean by that is I don't mean you've got to be like pissed off about something or you've got to be upset about something. I mean, you've got to have a frustration or an anger towards the thing that you're working on. So take the example of someone who is going to try and body, you know, to go for body transformation, or they're sculpting their body, or they're, you know, avid gym goers and weight trainers, you know, these competition builders. Do you think they go in just because they're passionate? When they're actually pushing to build the muscle, you know, to build the shape, they have to use what we call aggression. In fact, in professional weightlifting, they use a product called creatine, which creates aggression, and that aggression drives them forward. So something that I instill in my clients and the work that I do, whether it's with organizations, small business, or the individual, is I want to know if you're passionate enough, but I want to understand that you are driven to make the change that you want to. Because as an entrepreneur, when you're going out there, it's not just about the value you bring, it's the change that you're enforcing to make. Otherwise, you're not really being entrepreneurial. You're not bringing value if you're not changing something. So right. Passion and anger or frustration are two prerequisites that I feel are necessary in this world of entrepreneurship.
Well, also the other thing, of course, is not everything you're passionate about is a business or will make money. Or will make, you know, necessarily a dent. And, you know, in the work I do, certainly with strategy, passion, when you're looking at purpose, is one part of the why you build the business. Of course, yeah, it's not sustainable. It's like you said, it'll get you out of bed, but it only get you so far. It's interesting that you integrate anger and aggression. And I know you're going into it from a motivational driving sense. But equally, I'm just going to ask you now and play devil's advocate a little bit. Is anger sustainable? If passion's not sustainable, is being angry a sustainable thing? Right, okay.
No, but they're drivers, you see. The thing is with this is when you look at it, for example, for me, I'm someone that talks all about disruption. I talk about being disruptive. You started part of this this interview with this whole thing where you asked marketers about disruptive marketing and what they're, you know, what does it mean? I get asked all the time, what does it mean to be disruptive? And for me, what I have is I have a passion in seeing people develop themselves which can then have the ripple effect on whatever it is that they are developed in to lead on to other things. But at the same time, I'm a believer that the world needs more disruption. We're not disruptive enough. And I'm frustrated at the fact that disruption is always seen... Oh, are you okay there?
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
I don't know. I'm often.
We've had our own disruptor there.
We've had our own disruptor, exactly. I'm often a believer, and my biggest frustration is that being disruptive or disruption seen as a negative connotation rather than a necessity. But we, you know, as a world, we need more disruptors. Disruptors evoke change. Change will have positive and negative effects, but the impact through the ripples will evoke a change, and that change can only bring new prosperity. So when you see people like Elon Musk, who, you know, has for years, he's the epitome of disruption. It's not that he's angry.
Yep.
He started with anger. He starts with passion. Then that anger and drive turns into the question, why not? Why can't we do certain things in a particular way? Why cannot we do this? You know, who are you to tell me that it can't be done? Because every day there is a new innovation that comes in where people previously have said that can never happen. You know, I don't want this interview to turn political, but Brexit shouldn't have happened. Donald Trump shouldn't have been in power, but it's happened. Why? Because
they disrupted.
And they were people are angry. And at the end of the day, that frustration drives to an action. So that's why my context is a 1% change in your perception equals 100% change in your results.
Okay. I don't know where these sounds are coming from. I just have to go with them. Sounds like a lorry just parked or something like that.
Yeah, if anyone's listening that have got their thing on, probably mute it.
Yeah. Someone's parking a lorry and they've happened to invade our space. Please mute your thing. Stop disrupting our disrupting.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's interesting. And, you know, so when you talk about disrupting, you're talking about disrupting our own behavior to create better results. Because, mm-hmm. like you say, like Elon Musk, he disrupts industries, which is a very different concept, like PayPal that disrupted the whole way we paid. Facebook,
you know,
it was a disruptor of how we communicate, you know, socially, how we interacted online. And I think maybe there is a distinction between, or maybe not, correct me, between the disruption you're talking about versus being, you know, disrupting an industry, which is a very different concept. Is that
right? Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, my work goes on both accords, but I make a very, very large distinction between the two. You know, disruption is for me, first, disruptive is all about disrupting yourself. It's giving your persona, your behavior, your perceptions a jolt, which actually changes the way in which you see things, you act, you behave, and you react rather than react, respond to. We also work from the other side, which is more the business disruption, which is where organizational impact, corporate innovation, and new technology acceleration and incubation comes from, which is more about disrupting industries. But I'm a believer that, you know, as Zig Ziglar says before, we don't build businesses, we build people. And it's those people that build the businesses. If you can't disrupt the people from within, so if you can't effectively change the attitude and behavior of your employees or the people that will be serving those industries, then how do you expect to disrupt the industry? So for me, there are two sets of ripples. You've got a ripple from within, and then you've got a ripple within the industry itself.
Interesting. And this is a good lead to one of the points that you make is you change your results by changing your actions. Now, how does one disrupt their own actions if they don't know how to disrupt? If that makes sense as a question.
It always makes sense. Everything in disruption makes sense. The rule number one, guys, if you are someone thinking, I need to disrupt, but I don't know how to disrupt, the first rule of disruption is to forget that you're trying to disrupt. It's the very notion, because if you keep it in your head that you're trying to do something, you're never going to get it done. You'll keep going and say, oh, I've got to do this. Now I've got to do this. And what happens is the more you tell yourself, the less you'll do about it. You'll start to procrastinate more than anything else. I have three key pushes out in terms of three key essential pieces when it comes to being disruptive. The first thing is you have to challenge convention. So, one needs to ask one's convention, oneself's convention. Am I doing things the same thing all the time? Is this the same result that I'm achieving of it? What do I want to change within my result? What do I need to change within myself to evoke that result? The second part to this is to create an imbalance. So once you start thinking about being disruptive, you're going to create an imbalance. Now, that imbalance, a lot of people, when we talk about doing something out of the box or being a little bit controversial, most people are worried or fear how they're going to be accepted in society or how they're going to be accepted around the other way. So if I change the way I do something, someone's going to complain about it, or I won't be seen to be as whatever it is, the way I'm seen by people in the first place. The whole purpose, the second part of creating imbalance, is if you are upsetting people or if you're upsetting the norm, that means that you're actually disrupting. You're changing the way in which the behavior and the attitude towards something. And then disruption isn't something that happens overnight. It's something, it can be part of a lifetime. It can take a lifetime to disrupt. But what you have to have is that continued action. You've got to keep doing what you're doing. Because at the end of the day, not everyone's going to understand you straight away. Not everyone's going to value what you're trying to do. Most people will say you're crazy. Most people will say, why are you doing this? But what happens is as they start to understand, they start to create what they call a value proposition towards your action. As a result of that, they then start to accept it. And I give you a great example of that, again, in U.S. politics with the new elected president being Donald Trump. There are people that said he should never be in power who are now conforming to the fact that they're gonna work with him. They're gonna give it a chance. And the fact of it is it's not just I have no other choice. Everyone's always got a choice. It's the situation is that they're at the end of the day, their perception has changed to the fact that they've got to try and bring something positive out of this. So their attitude changes towards things. So being disruptive, just again, quickly, you've got to challenge the convention. So this is not, it's about doing things differently. And, sometimes disruption is experimental. I'm not saying it's right all the time. I mean, I've been told I'm a mad person, so I shouldn't do this. All the way through to why would you do something like this? At the end of the day, in 2011, when we had the riots here in the UK, I came up with an idea to bridge the gap between industry and young people by having a showcase event, a landmark showcase event. Never put an event before on in my life. Didn't know how to do it. Everyone that I'd speak to, no way. They put the phone down. Event companies put their phone down. Corporations put the phone down on me. I got to a stage where I said, the only way I'm going to get this, make this happen, is if I can get someone with seniority or power behind me. So I came up with a crazy idea of getting the prime minister involved with what I wanted to do. But it wasn't it wasn't as straightforward as picking up the phone to the prime minister and say, back then,
yeah,
David Cameron.
Tell us a little bit about this, because if I remember correctly, you grabbed him or something, didn't you? And you're like,
yeah,
hey,
yeah. So
listen to me. Yeah, tell us about that, because that's a great story.
So here is the three things about challenge convention, create imbalance, and continue action. So when I created the convention, the way in which the industry and politics was serving young people needed change. And I wanted to bring an environment which allowed industry to remove the veil on opportunities and for young people to step up and see what they could do with their talent for the future. But as I say, people didn't understand me. This is the imbalance part. This is where people were like, I don't get it. Look at the state of what they've done to the country. They've been looting. They've been ruining businesses, all these kind of things. Why would we be able to, I can't put my brand in front of that. I can't support this. This is what they were telling. So when I got to this stage within my head where I said, well, look, I need some seniority or I need someone with that kind of power that can really make things happen, and came up with this daft idea of getting the prime minister involved, it wasn't as easy as picking up the phone and saying, all right, Dave, can you help me out? I couldn't just walk up to Downing Street and just turn around and say, let me through because I need to see my prime minister. I did do the whole 6 degrees of separation. I gone and found people who were connected. And over a 6-month relationship build, I managed to get myself in April 2012 to Downing Street. And that moment in time, at that moment in time, I thought I was meeting the Prime Minister. And actually, I wasn't. I was meeting one of his special advisors who sat there for an hour, nodded at me as if he was nodding, listening to his iPod or whatever. And at the end of it, I got the whole, send us some information and we'll get back to you. Remember I told you about passion and frustration?
Yeah.
You know, something deep-rooted me was passionate about doing this. But when I heard those words, I got so angry that I started to, I didn't beat him up or anything, but I started a verbal assault almost, you know, within reason, where I was like, can you actually stand for this anymore? Do you think the Prime Minister can have any more blood of people that have died trying to save their businesses? You know, the youth vote in 6 months, 6 to 12 months time is going to be really important. So everything was just coming out of my mouth because I was angry, not because I was desperate. At which point, as we got to the back to the number 10 door and I was getting my phone and everything given back to me, he said, look, send me, I can't do anything more for you today. Send me this information and we'll get back to you. As the door was closing, I thought I'd have a picture taken by the door. Just as I was having that picture taken, the door was reopened and it was the same guy. He goes, you know what? I've been thinking about everything you said. He goes, the Prime Minister's hosting a reception this evening. Why don't you attend? I said, will I get to see the Prime Minister? And he said, yes. Now, I'm going to keep this quick, but this is the whole part about continued action now. Continued action. Sometimes even the wrong actions can end up being the right actions. You just don't know, because the whole part of disruption is to be different, to evoke change, positive and negative. I left Downing Street. I had 2 hours to kill. So I turned around and instead of going to a coffee shop and sitting down, I went into a bar or a pub and I sat there for 2 hours drinking beer. And I was Facebooking everyone to say I'm going to meet the Prime Minister and all this, all that. 6 o'clock comes around. It's raining. I haven't got an umbrella. I smell like a brewery. My head is spinning because I haven't had anything to eat. I'm so excited. I've now got to walk my way back to Downing Street. I get into Downing Street looking like and feeling like a drunken rat. Went up these stairs into this room, saw this, all these people, Facebook, McDonald's, Home Retail Group, Shell, all these big, big companies were there. Little on me. I'm like, what the hell am I doing here? Dutch courage, pick up a glass of wine, neck it back, then stand and take another one and another one. So I've now had a couple of beers, a few glasses of wine. I'm feeling a bit jelly wobbly. Prime Minister turns up. I'm like, oh my God, he's here. Gives an amazing speech and then does something. He takes 2 steps down off the stage and he comes into the audience. And I'm like, oh my God, he's going to now come and meet everyone. He's getting closer and closer, and as he is, for another bit of Dutch courage, I went and grabbed another glass of wine, necked the whole thing back. He's now in front of me by this time. He turns around and he says, hi, I'm David Cameron, and I'm like, yes, I know who you are. And then he's like, so what do you do? I'm like, how long have you got? You know, when we talk about you've worked 6 months to get somewhere, and then you fluff your lines? Well, I was fluffing my lines. I started to debate this with myself while the Prime Minister is still in front of me and I'm shaking his hand. So guys, get this visual of someone shaking someone's hand quite vigorously and still kicking themselves. At which point the Prime Minister grabs his hand back out and he says, well, look, thank you very much for coming. I've got other guests to see. Please enjoy the reception. At which point I'm like, snap back into reality. I click back in. I'm like, oh my God. And I did what would be the first knee-jerk reaction. I literally reached out and I grabbed him by his arm in Downing Street, in a crowded room. And I thought, oh my God, that's it. I'm going to be reprimanded. I'm going to be arrested. I've manhandled the Prime Minister. But actually what happened is by grabbing him, I got his attention back. And in 45 seconds, I pitched to him what I wanted to do. That was April 2012. In July 2012, he wrote to me supporting my event. In October 2012, I hosted Youth Enterprise Live in the UK that socially impacted 18,500 young people. We gave away £750,000 of startup funding through the Startup Loan Scheme. The Startup Britain bus tour started from my show. We gave £150,000 towards social impact projects through O2 and the Think Big program. 3,000 apprenticeships and 300 jobs in 2 days. Not hard to make. After a couple of weeks after that event had finished, I got summoned back to Downing Street. And the Prime Minister actually called me a bit of a disruptor, hence why I have that on my card. And he offered me a special advisory position on youth policy. And that launchpad me internationally. So ministries and governments from around the world started to listen into the stuff that I was doing on youth entrepreneurship. And before you know it, I'm jumping on planes, going to go and help other parts of the world with their youth entrepreneurship issues. So it just goes to show, guys, that, you know, you've got to challenge convention, you've got to create imbalance, and you've got to continue action. And understand that sometimes you don't even know where your disruption is going to take you, but it will take you somewhere to where you want to be, as long as you're passionate and you're frustrated about what you're doing.
That's a great story. And also the moral story is don't drink too much before meeting someone like the Prime Minister.
Yeah. I didn't drink anything the next time I saw him.
I'm
believe
sure.
Me.
No, look, I don't know who is different. I'm just going to just share some other shows up and coming over the next couple of weeks so people can listen to other disruptors using your terminology. So we've got Sean Wyman. He's on Wednesday between 7 and 8, and these are Eastern Standard Times. 7, 8 p.m. Catch him. There's Cindy Poe. She's Monday between 7 and 8 p.m. as well. So she'll be an old... No, this is Eastern Standard Time. And there's Catherine Huber, who I believe is making her day fantastic. Her energy is explosive. And she's Eastern Standard Time between 2 and 3 p.m. And then, of course, there's Amy, who every other week when I'm not doing it, she does it. And she's the same time as me between 2 and 3 p.m. So tune into these guys. They're hot. They're good. What they've got is massive value, so I suggest you tune into them, have a listen to them, because they are pretty, pretty awesome. So let me ask you something. You grabbed the Prime Minister a little bit drunk, which is good. You then launched this massive thing because you were passionate about and or angry about the state of what was going on in the country. So tell me, at one point did you know that you had to invest in yourself? Because You say investing yourself is a crucial element of success, and I agree 100%. I also believe that people can get stuck in the investment part and not be in the implementation part. But for yourself, when did you know, like, hey, it's time for me to seek support or help? When did you know that it was your time?
Well, I think, in 2009, when I went self-employed, I started my first company within about 3 or 4 months of going self-employed, which was an outsourcing agency in the recession itself. So I was taking unemployed professionals, winning contracts, and I was getting them to undertake those contracts. I somehow, some way built a business and sold it within a year of building it and not really knowing what I was doing. The second time, the second business I then launched was roughly around 2010, mid 2010, which was a marketing agency looking for niche healthcare brands. But I brought into the world of technology by that time, so I knew about e-commerce and how to build, you know, these subscribe-based newsletters and stuff like this. And as a result, I ended up selling all my data to a well-known and well-established fitness magazine. So having two kind of launches and two, I would say, you know, mild sellouts, I still wasn't really really under the illusion that I was an entrepreneur. I thought to myself I was a business professional and I could do business, but I wasn't an entrepreneur. I just think when this project entertained itself with Youth Enterprise Live, and believe me, it didn't come without any of its challenges. You know, we did this event on the 11th of October, 2012. On the 4th of October, I was with Lord Young and James Kahn during the startup loans phase. And oh, yeah. I had a call from Earl's Court, where I hosted the event, saying you haven't paid your bill and you've got 24 hours to find 24 grand. Otherwise, we don't open the doors. We managed to resolve that issue because there's a lot of people that were paying sponsorship or for their stands and stuff like that as part of the exhibition. So we just mustered all that money up and we got it sorted. But imagine this, Elliot, on the eve, the night before the show, this is on the 10th of October, I'd just done interviews with the national press. All my sponsors have been in line. People have been coming in, dropping off their stuff to set up their exhibition, you know, their expo stands and stuff. Everything's gone. I get a phone call from the US company who managed the carpeting and the stalls and the setup, saying that there's a 30 grand outstanding invoice which needs to be cleared before the show goes live. Otherwise, we don't switch on the power.
Wow.
And, you know, for me, most people would probably collapse and die. My event director that I'd pulled in was crying. My, you know, my design team were completely dumbstruck by this. I looked at it and said, the show must go on. No, you know, even if it's half a show, even if it's a quarter of a show, something it has to give. We have to finish this. Why? Because it's important that we deliver on what we deliver something. Otherwise it's not worth doing. You know, what's the point in going through this whole process in the first place? So I managed to muster up and scrounge, and I put all my savings, everything, my wife's savings, everything that we possibly own, put it all into it, managed to get around about 22 to 24,000 overnight. Didn't sleep all until that day, told that company, you're going to have to give me a £6,000 credit and we'll sort that out after the show. The show went on. And as a result of this, when I came back and reflected after the show and what happened to me personally, it's when I started to think to myself that this is when I really need to start investing in myself. Because at the end of the day, I'd managed to do something, and I did it from a very unconscious state. It was very much, I was aware of what I was doing, but I wasn't aware of how much ability I had. And there's this saying, Elliot, that power is nothing without control. And for me, I felt to myself that sometimes I was overpower and sometimes I was underwhelmed. And what I needed to do is be able to invest in myself to understand what that power is, how that power works, and where that power resides. So, you know, my first kind of investment wasn't in any training. I didn't invest into any NLP or any sort of speaker coaching or how to run a business. My first investment was very much into mentoring, which is it was key to me that I needed to have people around me that have experience of this, but they also can see something in me, not just the fact that they've been there and done it, that they'd be able to read me or look at me in a way that I wouldn't normally look at myself and be able to drive me to the next level. And that's how I invest in myself. And you raised a very important point. A lot of people do invest in themselves and they invest hundreds of, you know, thousands of pounds, but they're much of the closet course buyer, or they'll go to, to big events where they will, you know, they'll be inspired for 2 or 3 days. But then all the products and outputs from their training become something that keeps the coffee table upright. You know, there is not enough action. There's, you know, there is more perseverance, not enough action. For me, what I believed in is the simplicity of things. I don't need to be trained into do something. I know how to do it. Yeah, I could demonstrate to myself that I could get myself a job even when the job wasn't there. I demonstrate to myself that I can sell. I demonstrate to myself that I can strategize. I demonstrate to myself that I can be an idiot and get drunk and manhandle prime ministers. But the one thing that I didn't have control over was the power. Where was my power? And that's where I invested. So, you know, I didn't need quick answers or quick solutions. I needed in-depth knowledge of what I've got to be able to do. If once I got that knowledge, it enabled me to then become more and more better at what I do. It allowed me to refine my skills. So that's when things like coaching really come in, or practicing. So the proverbial trainer who helps you then get to your goals. So the first thing I invested in was, you know, someone or a group of people that could see me in a different way. Because that, ever since I was young, it was always a situation: you've got potential, you just haven't got the pace or the power. But when I'm passionate and when I'm, you know, angry about something or I'm focused into it, believe me, I can be just as great, if not better than the best, at doing what I wanted to do. But to enable me to progress in my future, I needed to find that power. And then once I knew that power, I needed to understand how I controlled it. So that's how I invested in myself.
So who are some of the people, you know, that you look up to in your space, or generally that you would either been mentored by or be like, hey, I'd love to have dinner with this chap, if you haven't already? Because I know you're very well connected. So who are some of the people that inspire you?
Let's do it this way. I think, you know, people that really inspire me are people like Elon Musk, even people like Steve Jobs. These are and not from the pretentious way of the fact that they are groundbreaking in what they did. They were just relentless, and there was an edge of narcissism within them that meant that they understood their own power, you know. And this is my sort of true calling. I mean, there are people like Gary Vaynerchuk that's in that kind of horizon and myth. And I've had the pleasure of speaking in a boxing ring with Gary Vaynerchuk in March this year. You know, so in terms of who inspires me, are the people that I'm not saying they disregard naysayers, but they absorb them, but still carry on. That's been really important to me, you know, from an inspiring point. Who would I have dinner with? I think people like Tim Ferriss and Russell Simmons and Tony Robbins, I guess, to a certain extent, with people that I would actually have a casual dinner with, where you could be very, very casual on the overflow. And it's really more on where their minds work or how their minds work. You'll find that most of these successful icons that we have very simple mindsets. You know, they don't complicate things. They don't complicate their systems. They have a very simple vision. They have a very clear vision. And the biggest thing about this is they're able to control their power. They know when to turn it up and they know when to slow it down. So, you know, there's a trend forming here. Then I think, you know, there's groups of people that I'd just like to have casual drinks with. And I think for me, casual drinks is more of an exploratory thing. I think for me, that people like Jack Dorsey, founders of LinkedIn, right the way through to emerging entrepreneurs who are, you know, today who are fighting against things and winning, they're kind of a source of inspiration as well. So they're the kind of groups of people that I would have. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with and having some social with Richard Branson, and believe me, he is a man of immense talent and ability and humbleness to a certain extent. But as I say, each and every one of these people that I've connected with over my time and my jurisdiction of working within this space, I found a commonality in them, which is simplicity, drive, passion, frustration, or anger. They're the four things that I find. And I think, you know, if I keep practicing these things, then maybe one day I can be a Vaynerchuk or a Robbins or a Jobs or a Musk.
Well, you know, if you're going to have a dinner with Robbins, you'd have to have vegan. So you just be
That's
warned.
Fine. Don't worry. I'll eat anything and everything. That's not a problem. It's I'll probably surprise him. I was 2009 as a quarterfinalist on MasterChef, so I'll probably cook him something.
Oh, there we go. Well, you know, there's so many people in our space that are very close to him. I suppose all you need to do is ask. It's interesting because there was a time I really wanted to meet Tony Robbins. And this is a few years ago. And actually, someone I knew him well. And in the end, I also was very good, very close to Gary King, as you know. This person said to me, look, If I get you a meeting with Tony Robbins, what would you offer him? And I was like, I'll show him my book. He went, well, yeah, you know, everyone says that. And the question they asked me, and this is, this is 2009, how are you going to add value to Tony Robbins? And I really didn't have an answer at the time. And so I didn't take up the meeting because, you know, sometimes the whole you get one shot. And I felt that at the time, I wouldn't be able to make or add value to him. So I didn't take it. And then I was out in Florida, and I think Gary King is such an inspiring person. Anyway, I completely love him as a human being. Talking about someone who's disruptive, talking about someone who's angry, talking about someone's frustration, especially with people with self-worth. Seriously, if you want someone to interview on your show, which you'll give us a plug for later. You know, approach him because he's brilliant and he's so knowledgeable. And I remember sitting there, we were having drinks out in Florida, and he said, you know, Elliot, hi, you know, I didn't know him very well. He said, do you want me to call Tony Robbins? And I was like, why would you call Tony Robbins? He went, Well, you know, I work very closely with Tony Robbins, and normally when someone meets me, they want to talk to Tony Robbins. And I was like, no, Gary, I came to meet you. You're the person that inspired me. I have no desire to meet Tony Robbins because I'm here to meet you or talk to Tony Robbins. And then I said again, what would I say to him? Hello? you know? So it's interesting about taking your opportunities and knowing which ones to take. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, would you just say any opportunity, grab it, take it? Or is it a bit like knowing, because like, you talk about controlling your power, because I could have gone, hey, I met Tony Robbins, or I've met this person, versus getting the best out of it. What would you say on that line? You know, do you just go, hey, if someone offers it, take it?
I suppose there are, and I'm not going to sit on the fence with this, but I think it really depends on the circumstances. So to give you an example, this time last year, someone introduced me to Gary Vaynerchuk in terms of they just sent me a message and said, check this guy out. You love him. And I started to watch a load of his videos. And then sort of by January, I'm like following Gary to a certain extent. And I'm like, you know, every time a new video post comes out, I want to watch it, or I'm sharing his stuff, etc. I'm like, this guy is really good. He's really, really good at what he does. And I'm like, I'm building kind of this awe for him, you know, really in terms of his belief systems and the way he communicates. And then come March, you know, I was offered a position by someone completely off the cuff, saying, look, I'm bringing Gary Vaynerchuk to London. I'm looking for some speakers. You'll be in the ring with Gary. Do you want to do it? And it could have been like, I'm like, hell yeah, I'll do it. You know, from one sense, I wasn't really thinking about Gary. It was more the sense that I had an opportunity to give a disruptive story to, you know, to this path, especially the fact that it was in York Hall in a boxing ring. I mean, I don't know how many people have ever given a talk in a boxing ring, but the fact that Gary was there was also an additional bonus. I said, look, you get to meet Gary. And when I met Gary, it was actually interesting because there were two things I did. I had a conversation with Gary first on, you know, his why he does what he does. And then I gave him an observation from my perspective of what he does. And what I mean, you know, when you ask the question, what value would you give to Tony Robbins if you met with him?
Yeah,
I think
that was
your opinion,
years ago, by the way.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Elliot, the point of it is your opinion is more than value in anything else. Same thing I did with Gary. When I sat down with Gary Vaynerchuk, I said, Gary, you know what? I love your videos. I love you. You've got major following. I love the hustle. I love all of this stuff. I go, but there's something missing. Do you know what that is? And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, there are so many videos you put out there, and you're really powerful about what you do. I said, but I go, there's something really important missing, and I want you to know if you recognize that. And he said, just tell me. Obviously, time is quite short. And I said, if you don't mind me giving you an opinion. And he goes, of course not. And at which point I turned around and I said, you're very good at doing a what and why, but you never tell people how to do things. And he just looked at me in stunned silence. And I said, I know we haven't got long. I go, if you watch back some of your videos, I said, you tell people what they should do and why they should do it. You know, they should hustle. They should do this. They should do that. They should be up. They should be working, you know, when everyone else is partying and all these things. Now, what you do is you build an air of expectation into people when they watch this. They think, yeah, I should work harder. I should do this. I should do that. And I go, everyone else is partying. I'm working. But they don't know how to do it because you don't teach them the way you do it. And he goes, but I can't. He goes, I'm not a teacher. And I said, precisely. I said, what if you changed some of your videos? What if you added a little bit of this is how you do it? And you know, that was it. I said, look, I go, it's just an observation. It's just my opinion. I think, you know, who am I? I'm no one. I'm just someone with an opinion. I said, if it helps you, it helps you. If it doesn't, doesn't. Gary does a lot of videos today where he tells you how. I'm not saying you just listen to me, but
he changed
it could
his
be
life.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not saying that it was a be all and end all. I mean, Gary will probably listen to this and say, shut up, but you'll be like, no way, it's not you. But my point being is you know, it depends on the circumstances. If someone, if there's someone that you're, you just be careful. If you're in awe of someone, you, it can change your experience because you hold them so high, and then when you meet them, you can be disappointed. So it's about managing your expectation. Now, always, I always believe that everyone has a value by through their opinion. If you're not ready to listen to my my opinion, then I'm not ready to give you one, or to even listen to yours at the end of the day. But the fact of it is, we all are individual, unique creatures. We all see things in a different way. And all it took is a conversation, which has now held Gary and me in contact properly, you know, physically for a long, long time now, where I think to myself, do you know what? Most people are like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I want an autograph, I want a picture, 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 all of these kind of things. Have a conversation. They're human beings. They're the same as you are. So I think, you know, it's you know, there are two cases. In some cases, you may think to yourself, this moment may never arise itself. You've got to take the opportunity, seize it, and do the best that you can with it. In other areas, I feel like if someone's presenting me with the opportunity and I don't feel it's right in my time, then I may turn around and say, I'm not ready to meet this person just yet. But at the end of the day, when will you ever be ready? When will you be prepared? I think it's better to take on the opportunity, but always go with the view to add value. There, you know, Tony can have value added to him. Barack Obama could have, you know, Donald Trump.
Oh,
everyone
can have
value.
Can have a lot of value. Obama can have a lot of value.
But it's kind of a situation. It's the complex that we put into our head. The perception is this person is way above me. You put them on a pedestal. And because you put them up on a pedestal, you yourself are creating a perception that you can't relate to these people. And that very person is a human being. When you relate to them like a human being, believe me, you get a better response from them than if you just said, oh, I love you, man. I love you, man. Can I have a picture, man? Can I have an autograph?
I agree. In other words, then, now I don't elate anybody. I really have got no – I respect people for where they are. I accept they're ahead of me, but never above me. And I think, you know – that was then, and this is now, and I've met some incredible people who are very, very powerful, you know, and absolutely, like you say, they're all human beings, they all want a lot of simplicity, or not, and then you have to really understand their model of the world. There's one person I really want to meet, because I want to sit down, I want to have dinner with him, and that's Simon Cowell, and that's not because I'm a groupie in any sense or form, but I want to understand how he does business. Probably me and many other people. I want to understand how he sees things, because clearly he doesn't just see a single. He sees a tour. He sees a TV. You know, he's massive. So if anyone can introduce me, Simon Cowell, and
Simon's an interesting story.
By the way,
story,
we've only got 2 minutes.
Very quickly. Yeah. Simon's an interesting story. I mean, here's someone who's down to his last 50 pounds watching TV, all this kind of part of his story. But Simon himself is a very simple guy. You look at all these people, they're very simple. You know, they're actually quite humbling. They're, you know, but the thing is, what happens is we create this fuss within ourselves, and as a result of that, that kind of energy flows into them, and that's when they become distracted. Now, yes, there are going to be times where he's impatient. There are going to be times when he hasn't got time. But the most of it is if you treat the people with as a human and as a, you know, on a level par of respect, you can connect and engage as much as you want with anyone, really.
Absolutely. And by the way, years ago, when Gary released Crush It, I was negotiating with his office to bring him over with some partners. Unfortunately, that partnership fell apart and we never brought him across. Such a shame. But there we go. We live and learn. So look, we've only got like 1 minute, 40 seconds. Yeah. Kitten, how do people connect? What do they do to find out more about you? What do they need to do?
Okay, so I'm available on all social channels. You can go on Facebook and just put in my name, Kitten Makwana. You'll find me. There's two pages, my public profile and my public page, or you can go for Enterprise Lab. You can search through any of the social streams that way through. You can find me on LinkedIn, just put my name in. There's not many of me there, but you'll find me, this beautifully bold looking guy, so you'll see that. For any of you that are interested in this, you know, the typical stuff like Elliot's doing here as well, I have the League of Disruptors show, which is a Facebook Live show where we bring experts on, and you can watch that live on my closed group called the Disruptor Den. So if you're on Facebook, go on to the Disruptor, you know, search the Disruptor Den. Just ask to join the group and you can come in and you can get access to those kind of shows. Other than that, if you're looking for any type of support, advice, guidance, or just generally connect to see how you can be disruptive, you can find out all my details at enterpriselab.co.uk. That's enterpriselab.co.uk.
Kitten, thank you. As always, you're awesome. I look forward to connecting with you and becoming even more disruptive in 2007. Have a great holiday season. Merry Christmas and all that, because I'm not sure I'll speak to you before then. My name's Elliot Kay. This has been Strategic Breakthrough Radio, and it's been disruptive. It's been awesome. And I want to thank you for tuning in. Till the next time. Kitten, you take care. Everybody listen.
You too, guys.
You take care, too. Bye-bye. Stay strategic. Remember that.
I can do anything, I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want, I can be what I want.